everyone. We are so very excited to welcome you to this deep dive episode of FP Next, now powered by John Deere. This is our farmer and rancher driven podcast from your friends at Farm Progress. I'm one of your co-hosts, Sarah McNaughton, and I'm here with Kurt Arnes.
Hi, Sarah. Greetings from down south in balmy Nebraska. Hey, I noticed when you introduced our podcast, you added a little line about a new sponsor beginning with this episode, right?
That's right, Kurt. And you know, I kind of thought it'd be funny if I sang the chorus of that old Joe Diffie song to lean into our announcement where he sings about something being painted in John Deere green. But I figured no one wants us to start singing here since we are an ag podcast after all. We should stick to what we're good at. With that idea out of the way, though, we are so extremely excited to announce that our FP Next podcast episodes going forward are now being powered by John Deere. It's a great partnership, and we are extremely appreciative of the good folks at John Deere for sponsoring FP Next.
Absolutely. We thank you to the good folks at John Deere for their support. And we also are thankful for our next guest, our guest today, who is going to give us some insights into the world of Brazilian agriculture. And we all know how our grain markets in the U.S. are influenced by weather and crop conditions in Brazil, because that country is such a powerhouse ag region for the whole world, really. So today we're visiting with an Iowa farm native who has firsthand knowledge of the Brazilian crops, weather, and agriculture in that portion of South America.
That's right. Matthew Cruz grew up farming near Royal, Iowa. Just over 20 years ago, he co-founded an investment company that purchased and operated Brazilian frontier farmland. So as the chief operating officer, he lived and worked in Brazil for almost 14 years, managing production on 22,000 acres of soybeans, corn, and cotton. Today, Matthew farms in Iowa and Brazil, and he still spends a few months each year in Brazil helping his family's operation raising seed beans, corn, coffee, and dairy. He has earned dual citizenship in Brazil and is fluent in Portuguese, and so Matthew can offer us a really unique perspective into agriculture in the U.S. and in South America. He is also a regular contributor to the Farm Futures magazine. He is a proud Cyclone alum, graduating with a bachelor's degree from Iowa State University in political science and communications, and he earned his executive MBA from Walden University. Matthew, we want to welcome you to FP Next today, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Honored to be here. Thank you.
Awesome, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us. We're really happy to have you as a guest today. We want our listeners to get to know you just a little better. So we're wondering if you could tell us a little bit about growing up around Royal, Iowa, and your farming experiences growing up. Now, Royal's up around Spencer, right?
Yeah, yeah. You're forgiven if you're not familiar with Royal. I think last population census, there was about 400 people there. So small town in northwest Iowa. I grew up on a pretty typical grain farm, small grain farm, just corn, soybeans and corn. I raised a little bit of feeder pigs when I was growing up and showed them at the famous Clay County Fair there in Spencer. It's the world's greatest county fair, as they like to say. So
absolutely.
But, you know, my father probably got out of cattle. He used to raise a lot of cattle and got out of that bite before I was old enough to really be involved with it much. And so I focused just more on the grains and a little bit of feeder pigs growing up.
You know, we're all really big fans of those small towns around here. And so now you farm in both Iowa and Brazil, but you lived in Brazil for many years. When you're working back home in Iowa, what do you miss most about Brazil? And vice versa, what do you miss about Iowa when you are in Brazil?
Yeah, what do I miss about Brazil when I'm here in Iowa? I suppose the weather is nice, especially I just came back here. And so I was there for 2 months in all of December and January. So there was a week here when it got down to 20 below zero. And so I was fortunate enough to miss that. But, you know, so that part is nice. But, I enjoy the agriculture and the farming. I mean, I think anybody that enjoys farming and agriculture and sees these big farms, I think is, really interesting to see. And so it's all relative. You know, I've had people from Pennsylvania come to Iowa and think we have these huge farms, you know, like they had some fields that are 5 acres and then they come and we have fields that are 100, 200, 600 acres. And then you go to Brazil and, you know, there's a lot of you know, fields that are 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 acre fields, and the farms are much bigger than that. So if you enjoy agriculture, diverse agriculture, you know, Brazil is a really fascinating country. I guess if, you know, what do I miss when I'm in Brazil, and what do I miss about Iowa? You know, I enjoy the food down there, but I suppose a good cheeseburger, you know, we still got pretty good cheeseburgers back home. But, you know, one thing I like, you know, maybe this sounds a little funny, but, you know, you have a lot more help in Brazil. You have labor's cheap. And so it's pretty common to, you know, have home assistants, like with maids and things like that, and cooks, you know. And where here, if someone had a maid, you think, well, they're a pretty wealthy person, right? Well, that's pretty common in Brazil, just because labor is a lot cheaper. And so when I go to Brazil, I don't have to cook or clean or do any of that. But, you know, as a guy, that's kind of nice not to doing. But when I come back to Iowa, then I got to go back to cooking and cleaning. And so I got to go back. I got to make my own coffee again when I'm back in Iowa. So I don't have to do any of that stuff when I'm down there. So it's kind of nice.
Wow. You know, I think that's kind of one of those unknown benefits. But hey, it's always nice. We don't have to do the cooking and cleaning, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, not only does Farm Progress have a wealth of experience in their editors and staff writers, but we're also so lucky to have knowledgeable and experienced columnists and writers like yourself on the team. I know reading through some of your recent articles on our website, I've learned a lot about the situation between Brazil and the U.S. With that, you, of course, have written many insightful columns about your farming experiences and insights into Brazilian ag for our sister publication, Farm Futures. Now, your degree at ISU is in communications. So what do you enjoy most about writing in general, and especially for those Farm Futures articles?
Yeah, I guess I've always enjoyed writing. You know, I don't know that it's something that I had planned on doing back when I was studying communications in college. But, you know, at Comstock Investments, we've been writing and providing a report called the Comstock Report here for 40 years. And just a lot of ag opinions and commentary and market analysis. And so then as I came back and joined the firm, then it was just kind of natural that I guess I was going to be the Brazil guy and start writing more about Brazil and my experiences there. I like to point out, I write about a lot of other things too. It's not just about Brazil, but Brazil, you know, is an interesting and popular topic. And so I think as time goes on, Brazil's influence is going to continue to grow. And as you know, maybe, I don't know, unfortunately, maybe for U.S. producers or U.S. agriculture, they're going to continue to grow and be a factor in determining what direction market price is going to move. And so we need to, I think, at a minimum, have an idea of what the crop is going to do and what's going on down there. And so I think that's, you know, why it's going to continue to be an important factor for, you know, marketing, grain marketing back home in the United States.
And also just a note, if anyone wants to read any of Matthew's articles on our sites, it will be linked in the episode description. So take a look there. And then also just a bounce off script just for a minute. We always seem to come back around to foods with our guests. And so we love to hear about everyone's favorites. And what I've heard is that the barbecue style meats and street foods are some of the top dishes to try in Brazil. But what are some of your local favorites you enjoy while you're there?
Well, I'm a pretty simple guy, I guess, just a meat and potato type guy. You know, I like their meat down there. You know, maybe not everyone would like it because it's mostly grass fed, right? So it doesn't have quite as much marbling on it as a lot of U.S. steaks would have, but they season it pretty well, and so I still really like it. Their picanha is probably one of their better cuts of meat, which is basically like a round steak. I remember that was probably one of the hardest transitions I had to make in the beginning. Like, the language didn't bother me, you know, lack of Wi-Fi or being in the middle of nowhere didn't bother me. It was kind of the food in the beginning that I had a hard time getting used to. And, you know, my first several months, I didn't eat much. And I lost a lot of weight. I don't know what I lost. I might have lost 20 pounds or something like that. But like, rice and beans is a staple at every meal. And I avoided that rice and beans like the plague in the very beginning, and to the point where I was actually losing weight. And I remember one day I was on the farm, and I came back up to our cafeteria on the farm, and I was so hungry. I was like, all right, I just got to eat something. So I had a little bit of rice and beans, and next day I had a little bit more. And now 20 years later, I love rice and beans. And so
it's, you kind of acquired the taste over time. And it's funny here. We always talk about food, Sarah, every single time. I think we'll do a side podcast just on food. So I'm glad that
Matthew we'll
could share a little, that you could share a little bit about, acquiring that taste. I suppose we should get down to our focus here, and that's Brazilian crops and agriculture. Now, you manage like 22,000 acres of farmland in Brazil for quite some time, and that's a lot of acres. I mean, how did you first get interested in Brazil? What was your motivation, for co-founding an investment company working in Brazilian farmland? And what opportunities did you recognize through that venture?
Well, going back to the beginning, my first trip there was in 2001. And so it was just about getting ready to graduate from Iowa State. And like a lot of Americans, I didn't know much about Brazil. I knew, the bare minimum, right? That there was the Amazon rainforest and there was a big city called Rio de Janeiro. I think that's what most Americans know. And so I went down there, completely green and just little by little, I mean, the first 6 months when I moved down there, I walked around with a pocket dictionary in my back pocket. And, I was immersed in the culture and no one, where I lived, no one spoke English. So you had no choice. You was either learn to order food or otherwise you're going to starve. And so I can remember just little by little learning a few words each day. But after 100 days or 200 days, well, you start to form kind of the basis for their language. And I think what originally got us down there was just the cheap land and labor and looking for opportunities. This was around the time when corn prices were depressed, at $2 or even less maybe. And it seemed like land was expensive and maybe it was at that time. Of course, now we know differently. But you could purchase land, at 1/10th or even 1/15th the cost of land up here in Iowa, good productive land. And so it just seemed like there was, it was difficult to grow and so competitive. And so it just looked like there was more opportunity there maybe to rather than just kind of bid up on rent like a lot of people do. And you're working at these cutthroat, narrow profit margins. It's just like, maybe this is just something else that we should try, another opportunity there. And so, when we first went down there, Brazil was producing like 35 million metric tons of soybeans, I think. And now, they've produced five times that. Last season they produced over 156 million metric tons, something like that. So it's like a 500% growth in soybean production the last 20 years. And so, Comstock, that my father started this company, this firm, and, being a commodity advisor, of course, was watching the markets and seeing what was moving and what's a major growth factor. And so he was, reading a lot about Brazil. And of course, that was all the rage in the early 2000s was the Brazilian growth and everything. And so he was the one that kind of came up with the idea and got us started. And as cheap as land was down there too, it still took a lot of capital. There's just it could cost $800 an acre with some of the land that we paid for in the beginning. And there were areas that were even more remote that were cheaper yet. And that was just buying the land. I mean, it cost several hundred dollars more to develop the land. And that was probably one of the things that we learned, that a lot of the value of the land down there was tied up in the development of it. So if you have the undeveloped pasture or cerrado, it's one price. But if you have land that is producing top yields with good fertility, well, that's a much higher price. Well, it could take you, 5 to 10 years and thousands or even millions of dollars of investment to get to that point. And so it's much different system than here in the United States, where our soils, our black soils, are much higher in organic matter, and the pH, natural pH, is much higher. Whereas in Brazil, it's less than 1% organic matter. The natural pH of the soils is like a 4 or even less. And so everything that you need to produce a good crop in terms of fertility, you have to put there. And so that was the big learning experience, but also can create an opportunity for you as well to kind of unlock that. And so, there's farms that we've been to in the past that they might have. There's one farm in particular I remember going to that was like 50,000 acres, this one property, but they were only opening or clearing like 2,000 acres a year. And people would ask me, well, what's their deal? Why don't they just hurry up and clear it all and plant it all real quickly? Well, it was probably cheaper at the time, but today, just to develop some of that and add the lime and phosphate that's necessary, you're talking $1,000 an acre, just the development of it. Well, if you're talking 80 acres, which is, a typical farm that's traded in Iowa, what is that? $8,000. What is that? My math's not too good. $80,000. Maybe we could come up with that. But these farms are 8,000 acres or 80,000 acres. Well, at times $1,000, you're talking a $1 million check, and there's really no financing. And so they're paying for this out of pocket, out of their cash flow and their profits. And you think about that, all the growth I talked about, there's 500% growth in soybean production. And much of that has happened with limited financing. It's impressive with what they've done. I mean, there aren't the 30-year farm mortgages like what we're used to. And so, that's kind of how we got started and some of the opportunities that we've seen there.
I know it's always so interesting to see the differences in agriculture, even across a single state, much less from country to country. And so with the impacts that Brazil agriculture and production outlooks have on U.S. and international grain markets, I'm sure our listeners are most interested in hearing about conditions right now in Brazil and how that might impact our grain markets going into the spring. You wrote a report in Farm Futures in early February about corn yields in the Mato Grosso, however you pronounce that correctly, region, kind of running all over the place, and how Brazilian farmers are shifting their focus to corn. Can you give us an update on how things are looking?
Yeah, so it's Mato Grosso.
Perfect. Okay. So,
they actually have three distinct corn crops in Brazil. The only one that really probably matters is the second one, which they refer to as the safrinha. And safrinha is the little harvest, and the first crop used to be 20 plus years ago was their main crop, which is planted mostly in the south, and the safrinha crop was, the way it started, was a rotational crop, and so they'd plant their first crop of soybeans, and they thought, well, there's a little bit left time in this rainy season, and that's really their only limiting factor is the rainfall, because they have a distinct rainy season and dry season. They're not concerned about, running into snow or frost at the end of the season. The temperature doesn't change all that much, a little bit, but not too much. So they're really concerned about running out of rainfall. They say, well, we got a few more months left in this season. Maybe we can plant some corn behind it. And so I try and tell people that they should look more at that corn, the second crop corn, more as a rotational crop than we're trying to get, 200 plus bushel main crop of corn. And so that second crop of corn represents roughly this year 77% of Brazil's total corn production. So you think, 20 years ago it was close to nothing. And now it's grown into 77% of their total corn output is in that second crop. But the average yield for that second crop, which is where most of the corn is coming from, it's 100 bushels per acre or less, maybe closer to 90 bushels per acre. So their yields really aren't that great. It's more, a lot of them look at it as, I like to make money on it, but if I don't, if I can just break even, and get a lower yield with lower cost, it's going to benefit my soybean crop the following year, which is my main cash crop. So it's a little bit different. Their soybeans are still their main cash crop, and it's followed and rotated with the corn. And so they aren't even, and I'll use Mato Grosso as an example. You know, they planted, Mato Grosso, just the state planted 30 million acres of soybeans here this last season. And they're probably looking at planting maybe only 60% of that is followed up on the second crop corn. So they aren't even planting 100% of their soybean acres to that second crop corn. And so there's a lot of potential there. What if, you know, they bump that up to 70 or 80% of their land base over time? And then, of course, you say, well, what if they, you know, instead of averaging 95 bushels per acre, what if they get up to 120 bushels per acre on their second corn crop? So there's a lot of potential there. Now, they've been experimenting, and you know, as timing's gone on, they you know, started to find out, well, the sooner I plant this corn, I generally going to get better yields because it has more time with the rainy season. And so and that's fine. The challenging thing is they then it kind of pushes their first crop of soybeans a little bit sooner. So rather than plant, you know, in earlier mid-October, you know, there's been a lot more people planting in late September. And that worked out great last year because they planted early September and they got good rainfall, and then they were able to get their corn in earlier behind that, and they produced well. But this year it didn't work out so well for a lot of them because the rainfall took longer to get started. So I don't know if I explained that well enough for you or not, but that's kind of where they're at. I think the conditions that their second crop corn are going in are really good right now. They're probably about half, a little over half finished in the whole country right now with their second crop corn planting. And in Mato Grosso, they're probably approaching 80% done. And that's, I reference Mato Grosso so many times because that's where that's the largest corn producing state by far. And so, you know, they're kind of the reference where most of the corn production, second crop corn production is in that center west region. And so I say by February, they ideally want to have all their corn in and that second crop by February 20th, because after that, it starts to get late enough where if it's planted in the late February or in the early March, they run a much higher risk of running out of the rainy season, entering into the dry season, right? And so we're now just past that point here. And so they still, people tend to risk it, you know, and hope for the best and hope they get one more rain in late April or in May, you know, but that's kind of where you're at. They still need good rains into the March and April timeframe for them to yield well. So when we took a tour group down there just last month, and we're in Mato Grosso, and we saw a lot of the corn planting taking place. Some of the tallest corn at that time, this was late January, the tallest corn at that time, you know, was maybe a little over ankle high. And so some of the very first corn, second crop corn, was planted there in around Christmas probably. But then there'll be some that'll wrap up here late February.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for an old Northern Plains farmer like me to get used to that kind of a mindset where you're not getting pushed at bean harvest with, you know, snow or something else coming up that seems like it's always around here. It's sort of that way. But I mean, do they ever have any weather crashes as far as, you know, trying to get that second crop of corn in? And then I'm also wondering, it kind of seems like that second crop of corn is sort of like a cover crop. It sort of keeps that living root in the ground. If your organic matter is low anyway on some of those soils, there's probably some benefits to having that in, not, you know, beyond just the financial, right?
Yeah, that's what I like to tell people, to educate them on Brazil and this second crop of corn. They should look at it more as a cover crop, or I maybe call it just a rotational crop. Whereas if they know that they're going to just break even on that corn, they'll still plant it as much as possible because they believe, well, I'll get 5 bushels more. But, you know, with my, rather than planting beans on beans, I'm going to get a little yield boost through the rotation of planting beans the following year. And so it's still, now obviously if they can, yield better, make more money. Why not? But you know, this 2024 season, they're kind of mirroring what's going on in the United States right now, where corn prices, they're underwater. Their cash price in Central Mato Grosso is like $3 a bushel, and they're looking at, you know, 100 bushel per acre yield. I mean, you can do the math. There's not a lot of incentive to overproduce corn there right now. But a lot of them are willing to do it because, hey, I'll get maybe 5 bushels more an acre on my soybeans, on my main cash crop the following year. That's really the impetus for that. It's the corn. And so, but it's just the area, the total area keep growing so much that second crop, rotational or cover crop, whatever you want to call it, grew along with it. And so you think about that, but man, what if they really start to invest in the second crop corn and say, we're going to try and shoot for, you know, 150 or 180 bushels per acre now. You know, then it could really, there's a lot of potential for expansion, but, you know, for the time being, it's just kind of limited to, you know, the timing and the weather, but, you know, that's been the good thing about Mato Grosso. You asked about the weather. If, you know, up until this season, they've had extremely tremendous rainfall in that area, and to the point where it's pretty tough to have crop damage. And so I would say this is, oddly enough, this is probably the worst year for their soybean production in that area that they've known due to inclimatic or adverse weather since production has been happening in that state the last 4 decades. And so we talked to farmers that, I mean, their yields were all over the place. There's one large operator that had irrigated beans that did 80 bushels per acre. And then they had dry land yields that did less than 10 bushels per acre. There are reports of fields that were abandoned just because they were so bad and they didn't want to run the combine through it. And so, and that's a first, I think, for Mato Grosso. And so kind of unusual year. Now it's an El Nino year in Brazil. And so they were kind of expecting lower yields to begin with. They weren't expecting a record yield. They actually reduced their projections from last year, but it was still quite a bit more adverse than what they were hoping for.
Sarah, I'm going to add an extra question in here just as a follow-up, if you don't mind. I was going to ask you a little bit about tillage systems. I mean, is it no-till primarily, or, you know, strip till, or what, you know, what kind of tillage systems are used, you know, predominantly, I guess?
Oh, it is predominantly no-till. Especially in I think the Mato Grosso and that center west region, but I would say everywhere in Brazil is predominantly no-till, very, very little strip-till. However, it's very common where all their fertilizer, I wouldn't say all of it, but the vast majority of it is all dry fertilizer. And especially on a lot of the newer soils, new fields that are being developed, they will basically side dress the dry fertilizer on with the planter. And so you have these big dry fertilizer hoppers together with the seed units. And so, and that's kind of necessary because the soil fertility is so poor starting out. Now, you know, eventually you can transition to more of a top dress application system when the fertility improves and phosphate levels improves, things like that. You know, but that could be 5 years into it or more. I think a lot of the cotton areas probably do a lot more tillage because that cotton has a pretty strong taproot. But this traditional first crop soybean, second crop corn is all no-till, and everything is top dressed with dry fertilizer. That's pretty their standard system there.
Kurt, what a great question to toss into this conversation today. I'm glad you thought of it. And now, of course, I've never been to Brazil, but I can just imagine the growing climates there and in Iowa are pretty different. And now you've already touched on this today in our conversation, but with your farming experiences in both countries, can you tell our listeners about some similarities and some differences in how crops are managed, maybe some pest and disease differences and challenges in the U.S. and Brazil, kind of comparing agriculture in our two countries?
Well, you know, I talked about missing the cold weather when I was here, but You know, that's actually a plus for the Corn Belt here, the U.S. Corn Belt, because you get these 20 below weather. I mean, that's going to kill off a lot of pests and diseases. Well, they don't have that in Brazil, right? So it's basically a greenhouse year round. And what that does is, you know, you spend a lot more on chemicals than you do in the United States. And where in my soybean crop in Iowa, I'll put one application of fungicide on. It's nothing for them to do 4 or 5 of just fungicide because the pressure is so great. And so the chemical market in Brazil has become huge because of that. And it makes the rotation that much more important. You know, one of the things that they do to combat that is they actually set moratorium dates on when they can plant certain crops. And so like in Mato Grosso, you can only begin planting on September 16th. And so I'm not sure when it ends. It's maybe June. So there can not be any soybeans growing in like the June, July, August timeframe. And so they monitor that. And so that's their way to kind of break up the pest or disease cycle. And that really started back in the early 2000s. You remember all the concern about Asian rust. And that really took off. And everybody was terrified of Asian rust in the United States. And they're tracking it, you know, coming up from Georgia or Alabama, and oh, it's moving north, it's going to get us. But it was a big deal. It caused a lot of damage in Brazil then, and that's how they did it. And it's the same thing, you know, in other crops. There's certain times of the year when you can plant cotton and when you have to have the cotton stock killed and all that. And so, that's one of the things they do to combat that. It's a pretty big difference, I suppose. You know, in terms of the equipment and technology, that gap has really shrunk to the point where I feel like they have access to virtually everything that we do. They got all these, 770 John Deere combines. I think they've even, you know, sold half a dozen, the dealership that we went and talked to sold maybe half a dozen X9 John Deere combines. Although in the same sentence, he says they're way more expensive. So I don't know if we're going to sell as many of those as the other ones, but they have them. If you want an X9 combine in the middle of the frontier in Mato Grosso, you can get it. That's the point, is you get how much do you want to spend on equipment? But I think we even saw a drone, spraying, doing some spraying. And so that's even, you know, still relatively new technology here. And so
yeah.
I think especially in that those big areas, all the global input companies want to be in Mato Grosso. They do all their testing there. And so Mato Grosso, in a sense, has become the new tip of the spear. I would say, because and also on irrigation, you can, you know, be doing tests year round. That's why a lot of companies in the U.S. used to or still do crop tests, like Monsanto, I know, did crop tests in Hawaii, because they could. It wasn't just a once a year thing. They could do field tests year round. And so that's kind of how it is. And so you go to the hotel in Lucas do Rio Verde in Mato Grosso. You know, you hear a lot of different languages being spoken. You know, it's all the European suppliers, American suppliers, they all want to, you know, get business up and going in this area, in the Brazilian frontier. And so I guess I would just say when I first came to Brazil, I saw, back in 2001, I saw cabless combines going. That still wasn't all that uncommon to see. The grain combine is going without a cab, which that, of course, is unheard of here in the United States. But that didn't take too long where it shifted away from that. But I always remember that in a 20-year, you know, it was a little over 20 years ago, 23 years ago, that you saw that. And now you go from that to 20 years later, you got these X9s rolling around someplace, you know. But if you were the farm that had the combine without the cab, you probably couldn't expect to get good help, because the help all wanted to go to the farms that had the cabs. And I think the farmers figured that out pretty quick. Like, if I want help, I need to upgrade my combine, because no one wants to ride around without a cab anymore. And so, but still, I just remember seeing that, like, that was crazy to see all the cabless combines run around just a little over 20 years ago.
Yeah. And that isn't that long ago. And I'm sure that, you know, I remember those days when they did have a few cabless combines around here, but that was a lot longer than 20 years ago. So and you kind of are addressing this. We've heard all about Brazil's ability to produce, but we've also heard about, you know, infrastructure challenges that they've had in getting crops, grain transported out of fields and into ports and that kind of thing. So, you know, what is the current situation there? I know it's improved a ton in the last couple decades, but can you, you know, kind of update us on, you know, are there still some current infrastructure challenges, or have most of those been overcome?
Oh yeah, it's still pretty poor in general. In the farming regions, I would say the only thing that has improved is there's less potholes. Some of the main roads I use, they were just riddled with potholes, and now they've got most of those potholes filled, which is nice. I guess that's an improvement, but over 20 years, they didn't exactly raise the bar very high there. They needed a lot more roads, and or they needed to widen or double the size of the roads, and that didn't happen. They needed railroads, and that didn't happen. It's very common where they make all these big announcements. And I remember in our area, this is 10 years ago or more, you know, like the governor came to the town that I lived in and made this big hoopla. Oh, we did it. We're building this railroad. It's going to come right through this area. And everyone got all excited. Oh man, it's going to improve basis and all that. And if you went in there today, there's no railroad, you know? And so there's so much talk, but it's just a lot of government corruption and nothing ever happens, you know? And it's frustrating. But however, you know, they had the, was it 2016? They had the Olympic Games there. And man, they're throwing up these billion-dollar soccer stadiums right and left, and suddenly they got all the money to build these soccer stadiums, but they ain't got no money to build roads or railroads or hospitals, you know. And so part of it's the corruption, part of it's priorities maybe. The one thing, though, I would say that has improved a lot is the port infrastructure, and that's really what's changed, because Brazil is an export-driven country. They aren't consuming all of these soybeans that they're producing. They got to get them out of the country, or the price is going to collapse and their farmers are going to go broke. Well, it used to be like Mato Grosso would ship the bulk of their soybeans 1,200 miles to the port of Santos, which is the largest port in Brazil. And that's still the case. There's still a lot of soybeans going down there, but each year less so that they have, I think it was just 3 or 4 years ago, they did finish asphalting a highway to the Amazon. And so just think about that. Just 3 or 4 years ago, it was the first time there was an asphalted road to the port on the Amazon basin. I think it was in the Santarém region. And so it's not that long ago. But a lot of that, the port infrastructure, that's all coming from private investment. You know, it's the Cargills and the big grain companies that are behind a lot of that. Not only them, there's a lot of local domestic traders that are interested in getting this grain out of there. But every year it's increasing. I think the last number I saw, it's well over 40%, and pretty soon almost 50% of the grain in that Mato Grosso or that center west region is heading out through some northern port, where 10 years ago it was almost zero. And so that's shifted a lot. That's taken the pressure off of the ports in the south, where you don't see quite as long lines as anymore. I used to see these pictures of these, you know, 10 mile long lines of trucks. You don't see that quite as much, but there's still some. And then you, you know, it's reduced the cost to ship grain out a little bit out through those northern areas. And so I think that's the biggest change. And you're going to continue to see that because it's in, you know, the world's interest to get the grain out of Brazil, you know, and so they want to stimulate investment in the ports and you know, you see COFCO is China's state grain trading company, and so the COFCO has purchasing stations set up in Mato Grosso. You know, they're going right to the source and buying the beans and then shipping it right out of Brazil to their country. And so, you know, it's in China's best interest to keep the grain flowing and the infrastructure up to date. And their best way to do that, the best bang for their buck, was, you know, the port infrastructure. And so that's the thing that's changed the most.
I have a feeling that infrastructure improvements are just going to keep growing and growing, kind of leaps and bounds, sort of like that open air combine going to, you know, the newer technology. Well, we could pick your brain all day, Matthew, I think, but we've had a really good conversation today, and we want to thank you very much for taking your time and visiting with us about, you know, current crop conditions, weather outlooks, and you've helped us kind of understand, you know, the systems approach in Brazil. So I know our listeners will be very interested in all of that information. And as Sarah said earlier, we have a link to your bio and Farm Futures articles in our podcast description.
Yeah, if anybody's interested, feel free to check us out at our website. And you know, every week I give updates on Brazil and the crop there, and at thecomstock.com, you sign up for the Comstock report, and we kind of give our projections for what their crop production is going to be.
Well, thanks again, Matthew. And to our listeners, we thank you for letting us join you on your farm, in your field, in your tractor cab. Thanks for tuning in and visiting with us today. A special thank you and shout out goes out to our production, digital, and marketing team members who put in a lot of work with us. And for those of you who are calving, please be careful out there.
I know we hope everyone out there is enjoying the balmy weather and having a very safe calving, lambing season as we're going forward this spring. We hope you've enjoyed this deep dive edition of FP Next, powered by John Deere, covering the hot stories you need to know about. Be sure to follow Farm Progress on social media to stay up to date with ag news and more, and check out the digital edition of your regional and national publications at farmprogress.com. Follow along with FP Next by listening and subscribing on your favorite podcast platform or at Farm Progress Online, and be sure to leave us a review if you enjoy the show.
5 stars are always good.
Be sure to tune in to our next Shop Talk episode of FP Next, which will be coming to you from Commodity Classic in Houston, Texas, where I'll visit with some of the Farm Progress folks and even a special guest on what this international event has in store for agriculture. We will also be releasing a special edition episode discussing anything and everything having to do with planter prep, so be on the lookout for those episodes.
We're all looking forward to hearing more from Commodity Classic and the warm weather down in Houston, although I'm not sure it's going to be any better than it has been around here. But Sarah, right. I think we should maybe have Matthew do our end tagline in Portuguese, since he is fluent in Portuguese. Would you mind doing that, Matthew?
No problem. Here we go. Se depende da agricultura, seus amigos do Farm Progress têm você cobrido para todas as necessidades. Do FP Next, desejamos você uma boa clima com alta produção. Até mais.
Thank you, Matthew, for letting us hear our ending in Portuguese. It's so cool. And remember, if it's agriculture, your friends at Farm Progress have you covered. From FP Next, wishing you good weather and high yields. We'll see you next time.